is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Martin Goldsmith about his newest book, which is called Alex's Wake, The Tragic Voyage of the St. Louis to Flee Nazi Germany and a Grandson's Journey of Love and Remembrance. Martin's been a longtime broadcaster. Yeah, he was on NPR and now hosts a classical radio program for Sirius XM. This is his third book, the second that's about his family in Germany and in America. To me, this was a really deeply moving book. Martin, it's really great to have you on Writer's Cast. How are you?
It's great to be with you, David. Thank you so much.
Well, I really found this book tremendously moving. I mean, I'm sure many people have told you that. It's the story of the relationship between your father and your grandfather. Of course, there are many other people involved, and your relationship to your father and your grandfather. But maybe you could, you know, tell us, just that basic motivation. What caused you to write about this? And I know this followed your earlier book, which was about your father specifically.
Well, in short, David, my grandfather Alex Goldschmidt and my uncle Helmut Goldschmidt, which is to say my father's father and my father's younger brother, were two of the more than 900 passengers who attempted to flee Nazi Germany in 1939 aboard the luxury ship the St. Louis, which was bound from Hamburg to Havana, Cuba. However, power plays in the upper reaches of the Cuban government made it impossible for more than just a handful of those 900 refugees to disembark in Havana. The ship then sailed north to the coast of the United States. It plied the waters off Florida for a week or so, the captain all this time attempting to get permission from President Roosevelt to disembark its passengers in Miami or Baltimore or New York City. But that request was denied. The ship was also turned away from Canada, and the ship then sailed back across the Atlantic towards Europe. The passengers on board the St. Louis were terrified that they were heading back to Germany. Virtually all of them had been arrested during Kristallnacht about 6 months earlier, and none of them had to imagine what would await them if they were to land back in Germany. But a deal was brokered at the last minute that enabled the passengers on board the St. Louis to disembark in one of four countries: England, France, Belgium, or Holland. My grandfather Alex and my uncle Helmut disembarked in France. They then spent the next 3 years, from 1939 until 1942, being shipped from one French camp to another, before, in August of 1942, being shipped to their deaths in Auschwitz. And that journey, as I say, happened between 1939 and 1942. Well, then 4 years ago, in 2011, my wife and I decided to retrace their steps. We began in the little German village of Sachsenhagen in Lower Saxony, where my grandfather was born in 1879. And we went from there to the town of Oldenburg, where he established a woman's clothing store and did quite well for himself, and where he was arrested on Kristallnacht, November 9th, 1938. We then went to Hamburg, from where the St. Louis sailed on May the 13th, 1939. And then we drove across the Lowcountries to metaphorically meet up with them in Boulogne-sur-Mer, where they disembarked in France in the late June of 39. And then we followed in their footsteps to all the places they were held captive over those next 3 years: Martigny-les-Bains and Montauban and Agde and Rivesaltes and Les Milles and Drancy. And finally, we took that lonely journey, long journey to the east, to the Polish city of Oswiecim, known in German as Auschwitz. So the book, David, is a story of those two parallel journeys taken 70 years apart. The book tells the history of what happened to my grandfather and to my uncle 70 years ago, and what happened to my wife and me as we followed in their footsteps and attempted to gain knowledge and also a certain degree of forgiveness.
Well, and it seemed You know, I think a big part of this was your father's guilt, and then exposed in letters to him from his father begging and pleading for assistance and for someone to do something, as he said, move heaven and earth, to do anything at all. And of course, you know, from the vantage point of history and reading your book, I wondered if anyone ever could have done anything that anyone could have done at that time would have been able to successfully get them released. This is during the period that they were in France, moving from displaced person camp to another after France had been conquered by Germany. So they were really, it didn't seem like there was any way out for them.
Well, yeah, the odds were heavily stacked against them. By the time they arrived in France, it was 1939. 2 years later, my father and my mother had managed to escape Germany to arrive in New York City on the first day of summer in 1941. They were able to survive that long because they were members of this extraordinary organization that I wrote about in my first book, The Inextinguishable Symphony. So they were musicians, and they were a part of this essentially propaganda orchestra that performed only for Jews. It was Jews performing for Jews. There was an opera company, an orchestra, a theater company, and my parents were kept alive because of that. And they were able to get out in 1941. And my grandfather and uncle were, as you say, still in those French camps. And they wrote with increasing urgency and fear, describing the conditions under which they were living. And yes, in the very last letter my father would receive from his father, Grandfather Alex wrote, among other things, "I have described to you the conditions under which we are living several times. This will be the last time. If you don't move heaven and earth to save us, that's up to you, but it will be on your conscience." Now, my father had only recently arrived in this country. He didn't speak the language very well. He initially got a job reconditioning the zippers of old pants for the use in new trousers, for which he was paid $14 a week. He had no connections. He didn't speak the language very well. So the odds are very, very much that the story would have played out no matter what had happened. But the fact remains that, as far as my father was concerned, he didn't do everything he possibly could. He didn't move heaven and earth. In the autumn of 1941, my parents, who, as I say, were musicians, managed to get a job at a music festival in Columbia, South Carolina, and they took the train from where they were living in New York City south to South Carolina and then back north again to New York City. And both times, of course, the train passed through Washington, D.C., and neither time did my father leave the train to go up to Capitol Hill to knock on some doors, which might have, and I emphasize the word might, have led him to a person who might have been able to make the right connection to make sure that Alex and Helmut did not get on that fatal train ride from Drancy to Auschwitz. So the odds were very much against him, but my father realized that he didn't do everything he possibly could have, and so certainly starting with the grisly newsreels that began appearing in 1945, my father realized that his entire family had been destroyed, had been murdered, and he had managed to survive, which engendered in him a great deal of guilt, which he carried with him to the end of his life.
One, and it sounds, as you describe it here and as I was reading it in the book, I felt like he needed forgiveness. And maybe he just wasn't able to ever find a way to forgive himself.
I don't think he was. And it's very interesting. When I did research for my first book, I learned that the people who had known my father in Germany in the late 30s and up until 1941, they described him as this very, very good-natured, very positive, almost jolly character with a quip for every occasion. He was gallant. He was a real ladies' man. He just enjoyed life. And the George Goldsmith I knew growing up was sort of the polar opposite of that, someone who was very much kept to himself, did not do terribly well in social situations. And there's no question that his personality was deeply affected by what had happened, and I can only ascribe that to the guilt that he carried with him, a guilt that he acknowledged occasionally, not very often, but occasionally. And I realized, you were talking some time ago, David, about what led me to write the book. I realized at some point that I wanted to learn more about the voyage of the St. Louis and what had happened to my grandfather and uncle, because I wanted to learn the facts of their voyage, of course, but my interest went beyond a mere spectator's interest. I wanted to learn all the details of the voyage of the St. Louis and about what had happened to Alex and Helmut, because I wanted to save them. And I realized that was totally irrational. They had been murdered 10 years before I was born, and yet I had I realized that I had somehow inherited this guilt that my father had carried with him for so long. He, in his mind, had failed to save his father and his brother, and so that responsibility had now passed to me. I felt like the catcher racing up the first base line to snag an errant throw from an infielder. I was the backstop, and this journey was a required. It was required of me to make sure that everything that could possibly have been done was done, even if it was many years too late.
Right, almost as if you were taking on the expiation of someone else's sin. I hadn't really thought about it in that way before, but as you're describing it, it's like you have to do it for your father.
Yes, I mean, for my father and for my family. I mean, I certainly wanted to bear witness, but I was also it was for me as well. And as I say, it's completely irrational. No guilt can rationally be laid at my feet. They were murdered in 1942. I was born in 1952. There was nothing I could have done. And yet, I realized that, I mean, for a long time, I was aware of a question that sort of hung over me like the mist at the back of an ocean liner. And that question was, how can I ever be happy? How can I ever deserve happiness when my grandfather was murdered at Auschwitz? So this journey was for my father, it was for my family, but it was also a great deal for me as well.
Well, you describe, all these places. First of all, you tell the story of your grandfather and the places where he was born and from, and all, a lot of family members. And I wanted to ask you also that, the story of the St. Louis, I can understand this complete frustration in imagining them looking out. In Cuba, they're in the harbor. They can't get off the boat, and then they're close to America. They're off the coast of the United States for all that time, and you can feel their just unbelievable frustration and this anxiety and desire and to be so close and not to be able to get off the boat. And it's just amazingly evocative of what it must have been like. Just you can palpably feel just the terror and the energy, the negative energy that must have been passing through all of those people. And to be on that boat for so long, it's just an astonishing story. And of course, you also gave the details of how that ship, how it happened in the first place, and that only Jews who could afford to pay this full fare could go, and that the shipping company and the Nazis were really happy to be making a lot of money as they were, carting the Jews they hated away from Germany, taking all their money.
Yeah, it was quite a unique way of being booted out of your country. Right this way, ma'am. Right this way, sir.
Right.
Your glass cabin. And after all, these were people, virtually all of them had been arrested on Kristallnacht. Virtually all of them had spent time in concentration camps. When my grandfather, Alex, when he was released from the concentration camp Sachsenhausen following his arrest on Kristallnacht, was told, you have 6 months to leave the country. And if you're still here in 6 months, we're going to come after you. And again, it took no imagination to figure out what that meant. So all these people were being essentially booted out of the country, but they were booted out on board this luxury liner, which is just the most mind-bending exercise when you try to wrap your mind around the whole thing.
Well, and it becomes, and of course, then there is the, you told the story of the captain of the ship who was avowedly an anti-Nazi and in many ways a hero, although he was not able to, he would not have known that all of the people that he was enabling to disembark who, except for the ones who went to England, he would not ever know that the other three countries were soon to be conquered by the Nazis.
Right. Now, Gustav Schroeder, the captain of the St. Louis, has been honored as among the righteous among the nations at Yad Vashem, the Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem. He was a heroic person, standing up to the Nazis, making sure that all of these people who, in his mind, had paid their way were due first-class treatment, first-class meals. But it must have been very strange for these people who had lived as second and third and fourth class citizens for the previous 6 years since Adolf Hitler became chancellor in 1933, suddenly to be booted out of the country with white linen tablecloths and fine champagne and lobster. So the journey of the St. Louis alone is an amazing story.
It is. But then equally your journey, I think, through all of the places in Germany and then France and then out to Poland, I think were really powerful because in many places you went, you also came across people who were involved in a similar way as descendants of people who had either helped or not helped, who had been on the other side or on the same side. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it really was extraordinary, the people we met on the road. And we were on the road for 6 weeks, and we traveled 5,700 miles. And we met some extraordinary people. The very first place we went, Sachsenhagen, a little village of about 2,000 people in the Lower Saxony in Germany, a very rural part of Germany. And Sachsenhagen is this little town that back in when the earliest Goldschmidt, the direct descendant, direct antecedent of mine, the first Goldschmidt, Levi Goldschmidt, was born in 1799, and he moved to Sachsenhagen in the 1830s. And from there, for the next 75 years or so, Sachsenhagen always had, between 8 and 12% of its population were Jews. But then, starting in 1942, when the convoys to the east began, the Jewish population of Sachsenhagen was reduced to zero. And today, that number is still the same. There are no Jews living in Sachsenhagen anymore today. And yet, when we arrived in Sachsenhagen and were shown around the town by the people who represented the little Sachsenhagen Historical Society, we found out that a few years ago, the primary school of Sachsenhagen, the only little elementary school they had in the town, was named Gerda Philipsen, the Gerda Philipsen School. And we learned that Gerda Philipsen was a little Jewish girl who was 12 years old in 1942 when she was taken to the East and murdered. And we thought, this is an extraordinary thing. I mean, there's this little village, 2,000 people, in the middle of the heartland of Germany. There are no Jews living here, and yet they named the school Gerda Philipsen. Why would they do that? And we were told, well, you have to talk to this former teacher, Rita Scheva. And we found Rita. She speaks very, very little English. I speak very little German. But we managed to communicate, and I essentially said, well, why did you do this? And she said, well, it has fallen to our generation to do what we can to right the wrongs of previous generations. So to her and to her colleagues and to her fellow citizens of Sachsenhagen, it is perfectly fitting that the only school in town should be named after a little Jewish girl who was murdered in 1942. And we met in the French village of Montauban, a fellow who was able to help us find what had happened to Alex and Helmut during the month they spent in their town of Montauban, where they were held as prisoners in a former cookie factory for that month of 1940. We found out that his uncle and his father were both members of the Resistance. And in his mind, helping me in 2011 was exactly what his grandfather and uncle had done in 1941 and 1942. So we really met some extraordinary people along the way for whom these incidents of 70 years ago seem to have just taken place a month ago or last year.
It did. One of the things I thought about throughout, and you have these individuals who stand out for being cognizant and emotionally engaged in the historical past and what that might mean for them in the present. But was it a minority of people? I mean, it seemed that these were exceptional individuals. And there were times when you expressed, some frustration with the circumstances where people were either insensitive or not aware of what might be going on in your for you, or even just to be tone deaf to what had happened, because it was not their current reality. It was something from the past, either that they purposely or inadvertently had no interest in.
No, I was quite shocked to discover when we reached the French city of Agde, A-G-D-E. It's down by the Mediterranean Sea, and Agde held a camp that was actually built to house refugees from the Spanish Civil War, and it was then later used to house former Czech citizens who were kicked out of their part of Czechoslovakia, the part of their country that Adolf Hitler called Sudetenland, or South Germany. And so after the Munich Agreement, a lot of these Czechs were booted out of their country, and France offered them the use of this camp, Agde, to live. But then it was also used as a place to house Jews, as the French began their roundup of Jews in 1941 and 1942, which would culminate in these long convoys from places like Rivesaltes and Les Milles and Drancy to Auschwitz in 1942. But when I got to Agde, there was a big, fairly large monument, a rather large stone monument to Agde. And as I say, there were a number of people who had been incarcerated in Agde, people from the Spanish Civil War, Czechs, the Jews. After, in the 1950s, a number of people from Southeast Asia who had been disrupted in their way of life by the French incursion into Southeast Asia. So there were a number of people who had lived in Agde, who had been held in the camp of Agde. And this big memorial, obviously the wording was in French, and it took me a while to translate what this monument said. And it said, in effect, to the memory of all these people who stayed here in Agde on their march toward freedom.
Oh, I know the irony.
And when I first saw that, I nearly fell over, thinking, who was so obtuse as to refer to the Jews who were held in Agde as marching toward freedom? Now, yes, you could make that statement towards as far as the Spanish and the Czechs and the Indochinese, But no, that was pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, and of course, there's so many things to talk about here, but you reminded us of how readily the French expressed their anti-Semitism as soon after they lost the war, without any real, they weren't ordered to do things by the Germans. They just went ahead and did them.
Yes. I quote a number of witnesses from the Nuremberg trials, and German officials who said, in effect, and we didn't have to put a gun to the heads of these people from the Vichy government, from Marshal Pétain and his fellow fascists, they were all too ready to join in this final solution. In fact, the very last camp where my grandfather and uncle were housed, Camp Les Milles, in the southeastern part of France near Provence, it was a camp that was totally built from the very beginning by the French. I mean, the French architectures, French architects, French builders, French designers, and it was built completely and utterly to hold Jews who were rounded up in Paris and elsewhere in 1941 and 1942. And one of the things I always want to emphasize to people who are thinking of reading Alex's Wake, that I make the point, and this is not in any for means of score settling or pointing fingers, but just pointing out that there were literally thousands of French camps. We all, I think many of us who are aware of the Holocaust, are aware of names such as Auschwitz and Treblinka and Dachau and Bergen-Belsen and the like. But how many of us know the names Ribesalt and Agde and Gurs and Drancy? I mean, there were literally thousands of French camps. And I think it's always very cleansing for people to come to terms with their histories. And it's good to know that the Camp Ribesalt, where my grandfather and uncle were held, is going to open as a memorial museum this September, in September of 2015. And Les Milles, that camp I just mentioned, opened as a memorial museum in September of 2012.
No, I think those are very, I think that's very important. And it's true of all of the countries where the Nazis took over, almost in every case, the local Nazi or fascists, I guess the local fascists, would arise and do what they were going to do, with or without the assistance of the Nazis, just with their permission, essentially. One thing I wanted to ask about, I thought it was a really important moment in the book for you and also for me, was in the town where your grandfather lived, the big house, which I think was Oldenburg. You discovered that house earlier in the book and met the people who had just bought the house, who had no idea that they had bought a home that originally had belonged to a Jewish family and had been more or less forcibly removed by, it was sold. I mean, the Nazis made them sell it at a ridiculously low price. So it wasn't confiscated, but it was as good as confiscated. So they're living in a house that they find out has this history. And then later in the book, there's a ceremony, and they'd put together a plaque to honor your grandfather and his family. And I thought that was a really powerful scene and a powerful moment for everybody. And you had brought some of your relatives from England to come as well, correct?
Yes. No, when we first went to Oldenburg in the first part of the story, we obviously visited number 34 Gartenstrasse, which is where my grandfather lived. As I mentioned earlier, he did very well for himself, selling women's clothing, hats and accessories. And he did so well for himself that he was able to buy this immense, beautiful house that was right by the former ducal gardens. The Duke of Oldenburg lived nearby, and his private gardens are now a public park. But my grandfather bought a house that was owned originally by one of the courtiers to the Duke of Oldenburg. So it was a beautiful, beautiful house, 12-foot-high ceilings, formal library, dining room, a wine cellar downstairs, 5 bedrooms upstairs, beautiful gardens with the strawberries and apple trees, and just a beautiful, beautiful house. And the people, yes, who bought the house, Karsten and Monica Meyerbolen, learned about the fact that my wife and I were in town, on this journey into the past, and they invited us over and gave us a tour of the house, and then at one point said, well, we would like somehow to express our agony to you, because I mean that the house is probably worth anywhere from $5 to $10 million, and my grandfather was forced to sell the house for 26,000 marks, which at the time was about $10,500. And they bought the house about 10 years ago, had no idea of the history of the house, and they said, we'd like you to consider our offer to put up a plaque on the side of the house explaining the history of the house. And at the time, I said, that's a very, very nice thought. Let me think about that. Thank you. And then I went home, or went back to where we were staying with our hosts, and I couldn't sleep the rest of the night. I was thinking to myself, I was reimagining that conversation back on 34 Gartenstrasse, and in my imagination, I would say something like, well, yes, Mr. Meyerbolen, that's a nice idea. We could do that. You could put up a plaque on the house, or I could give you 26,000 marks, and you could give me back my blanking house. And I realized that that was, not a very practical thing to have said.
Well, but this was a moment of high emotion.
It was very much a moment of high emotion, and it really provided a coda to the journey and to the book. After we returned from this 6-week, 5,700-mile journey, again, our last stop was Auschwitz, where the punchline of the story was Alex was taken off the train and immediately gassed. He was 63 years old, considered too old to work in the Auschwitz camp. My uncle was assigned, he was tattooed with the number 59305, was sent to work in barracks number 20, where he died 2 months later officially of typhus, though it's quite possible he was murdered by a lethal injection of phenol directly into his heart. And Helmut was 21 years old at the time. And I thought, leaning up against a tree in the Birkenau section of Auschwitz-Birkenau, having laid to rest photographs of my grandfather and uncle, I thought, well, here's where I really need to leave them in peace. Not only peace for them, but peace for myself. And I vowed at that time, for the rest of the time that I'm given, to try to leave Alex behind me, or to stop swimming in the turbulent waters of Alex's wake, and to spend more time in the loving embrace of my family and friends. But I found that more easy to think about than to actually do. And when I returned to the States and began writing the book, I was really enveloped by this great depression, which made it very difficult for me to continue. But then I heard again from the Meyerbolens reiterating their offer, and I decided that, yes, this really would be a thing to do. There are things called Storpelsteine, stumble stones, that have been erected in the sidewalks in front of a number of formerly owned Jewish businesses or domiciles in Germany. And the stone basically says, here, Mr. Schwartz or Mr. Cohen and his family lived here between 1870-something and 1940, so on and so forth. But nothing like this had been done in Oldenburg up until 2011, perhaps because Oldenburg, as it happens, was the first state. There's the state of Oldenburg and the city of Oldenburg. The state of Oldenburg was the first German state to actually elect a Nazi government. And that election took place in the autumn of 1932, 3 months before Adolf Hitler became Chancellor of all of Germany. So I thought, well, this would be a very good way to introduce Oldenburg to this idea of bearing witness. So, yes, anyone who goes to 34 Gartenstrasse today will see this plexiglass plaque that says, in this house between 1919 and 1932, the Jewish businessman Alex Helmut lived with his son and wife and two sons and two daughters and a wife. And Alex and his son Helmut were murdered in Auschwitz, and his wife and their daughter Eva were murdered in the Riga ghetto. And it says that in German, and then below that are two lines that I found from a poem from Emily Dickinson, and they read in the original language, "Remembrance has a rear and front, 'tis something like a house." So that plaque is now affixed to the side of number 34 Gartenstrasse in Oldenburg.
Oh, that's a beautiful line too. I have to ask you about your grandmother and, you know, the other side of the family. You know, what happened to them seemed, I mean, obviously the book was about your grandfather and your uncle, but there was very little about your grandmother. Is that, and do you think that's at least partly because, you know, you have less of a record? You don't know what happened to them?
Yes. I mean, there are more primary source materials, as they say. Some letters from both Alex and Helmut to my father and mother from these camps in France. But I also do have a couple of letters from my grandmother, Toni, and my grandmother's, my mother's mother. What happened was that my two grandmothers moved in together because my mother's father was a very, very fine violinist and a very good music teacher, but something of a rat in that in 1939, after Kristallnacht, he took his Stradivarius violin and a woman, not his wife, and was able to flee Germany for South America. He spent only a very short time in Ecuador before he died of what must have been a karma-induced heart attack. I have a lot more about my father's family. Again, my father's mother and my mother's mother moved in together along with my father's younger sister, Eva. They lived on number 160 Prinz Richthofenstrasse in Berlin, from where they were transported to the east in March and May of 1942, respectively. Yeah. But yes, I know more about Alex and Helmut, but my wife has encouraged me to write more about Toni and Eva as well.
Yeah, I think you should. I think it's just, I mean, it must be painful, and I cannot imagine how it feels, you know, as many, you know, you're a direct descendant of Holocaust survivors, and many others of us are maybe less directly related to those who were there. But I think it must be difficult regardless, even though you've done this great piece of work. I sympathize with the emotional struggle that you had with it. And, you know, I really respect the work that you've done.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. It was always so interesting along the road during those 6 weeks to come into a new place where I knew, you know, 69 or 70 or 71 years ago, whatever the exact date was. Some years ago, my grandfather and uncle had lived here for a time, maybe for more than a year, as was the case in Les Mills, maybe for 6 months, as was the case in Rivesaltes, maybe for 1 month, as was the case in that cookie factory in Montauban, where they were held. But each time I would arrive in one of these places, I would be simultaneously sort of exhilarated by standing on the spot where they once stood and breathing the air that they breathed and seeing what they saw, and occasionally coming upon artifacts where in Montauban I discovered these police records, which led me to the knowledge of that cookie factory where they were held. So whenever I would go into a new place, there was this exhilaration of coming into contact with them, ephemeral though it may be, and then moments later having the feeling of that snatched away from me, because realizing that as much as I wanted to have met them, and as much as I wanted to be following their footsteps, they always were 10 years ahead of me. And I was always literally and sometimes figuratively missing the boat. So it was quite an emotional journey of excitement and the thrill of discovery and the agony of loss.
That was a tremendous book. I really appreciated reading it. I'm really glad we got a chance to talk. I want to thank you, Martin Goldsmith, for writing Alex's Wake and for talking to me about it. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.